I can remember being a teenager. Amazing as that is that I can remember that. Having disagreements with my dad. Specifically, about my curfew. We saw a little differently on the hour that I should be home. Dad's reasonable hour was midnight. Didn't matter what the activity was, midnight. He was very inflexible on that. And I would challenge him on that. And Dad's response, a little more colorful than I will present it to you, was essentially this: son, there is nothing good that happens for young people after midnight. Period. No negotiation. That was his stance. So, you can imagine, at 18, I was a bit frustrated by that. So, at the end of my senior year, I graduated, and I took all of the accumulated wisdom of my 18 years, and I went off to college to live in a thimble, that's right. And I went off to live my life at college with that. The strangest thing began to happen, though. You know, as I got a little bit older, I'd go home for break twice a year. I was 2,000 miles away from home for school, so I would only get there twice, Christmas time and then summer breaks. And it seemed to me that every time I went home, my dad had gotten a little bit smarter. And by the time I graduated, I remember thinking that he had learned a whole lot in those years that I had been away at school. It was a rather remarkable transition in my father's life. At 18 years old, I was pretty sure that my dad was just trying to cramp my fun and not let me live, as you can imagine. But in just 4 years, and certainly well beyond those 4 years, I began to see more often his position on certain things for what they really were. The truth is, they were life-giving positions. He may not have communicated that in the clearest way or even in the most kind way, but my dad loved me, and so his decisions were quite often based on what he knew that I didn't. And I learned many years later a whole lot more about my dad and his high school years, and understood much more clearly at that point that he was speaking from experience. I think it's important for us to sort of keep that perspective in mind as we continue pushing ahead in our study of the Ten Commandments. This morning we have arrived at the fifth commandment: honor your father and your mother, so that you may live long in the land the Lord your God is giving you. It is the only command of the ten that has a promise attached to it. Now, at first glance, you might hear that promise as a fairly severe warning. Like, you better honor your mother and your father, or you're just not going to live to tell about it otherwise. Kind of like the mother who said in a moment of frustration, "Honey, I brought you into this world and I can take you out." I don't think that's what's going on there in the text. Paul reminded the Ephesian children in his letter to the Ephesian church, honor your parents for this reason, so that it may go well with you. I can remember times of disobeying my parents. Life did not go well for me at all. So our text this morning, I just have to warn you ahead of time, it's a gruesome text. It's Deuteronomy 21. And I've chosen it because I think it really sort of sheds some light on a foundational truth that underlies this fifth commandment. So let's stand. And with a bit of fear and trembling, I want us to read this together. From Deuteronomy chapter 21. Here we go. If someone has a stubborn and rebellious son who does not obey his father and mother, and will not listen to them when they discipline him, his father and mother shall take hold of him and bring him to the elders at the gate of his town. They shall say to the elders, this son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey us. He is a profligate and a drunkard. Then all the men of his town are to stone him to death. You must purge the evil from among you. All Israel will hear of it and be afraid. Yes, brothers and sisters, believe it or not, this is the word of the Lord. You were very enthusiastic in that. Go ahead and be seated. Can you imagine? All Israel will hear of it and be afraid. No kidding. Especially the kids. All right. So you know we've got to interact about this just a little bit, okay? So I want you to find someone nearby. And I want you to think about it for a minute. Why was it so important that children honor and obey, which is a form of honoring? Why is it so important that children honor and obey their parents? Turn to someone nearby. Ask them that. Talk about it for a minute. See what you come up with. Okay. What did your neighbor think? What do you think? What's going on? What do you think's underlying this? Want to take a stab? No, it's not really, you know, advocated as a form of discipline these days. What do you think? What's going on here? Thinking about who these people are, where they've been called from, what their purpose. Okay. And disobedience creates chaos. God of the Old Testament doesn't like chaos. Yeah. Why was honoring and obeying parents so important in this context? What else? Anybody else? Okay. Definitely. Good. Yeah. Parents were the driving force in molding and shaping a child. And of course, you know, the community that they're a part of. No, really? You think we should? Yeah. Okay. Bingo. Yes. No. Yes. That is exactly right. Yes. It's important to remember that these commandments were given to a group of people who were intended to do what? Proclaim the greatness and the glory and the goodness of God in a pagan land. They had been rescued from slavery. And the commandments we have said from the beginning, they are life-giving. They are intended to give life. They are intended to redirect and to lead people down a path that is life-giving. God was not some cosmic party pooper. He loved his people. They were created by him. They were created for him. And the life that we, as his people, are created to live in him is really the only life that is going to bring joy and satisfaction to our souls. Because that is the created design. And we've talked about that. That is underlying these commandments. Don't go looking for life somewhere else because it is only an illusion. You will not find the satisfaction that your soul is longing for because that is not what you were created for. So in the same way that my father spoke out of his experience with his knowledge that nothing good happens after midnight, God is speaking to his people in these commandments with the knowledge that nothing good happens in life that is lived apart from his plan. Make sense? It's a life-giving theme, and this particular one that I think we need to use as a lens to hear these words of this fifth commandment, keeping it in the context, and hear it for what it was intended to be. It was originally given to children whose parents, as Diane pointed out, were God's people. There is an assumption here that that these parents are living in obedience to the first four commandments that we have looked at together. Okay? So, let's remember real quickly. First commandment, have no other gods in your life. Why? Because there are no other gods. The first commandment is a supreme statement of God's existence, his self-existence, and his completeness. There is no need to look elsewhere for life. There are no rivals. By obedience to this first commandment, we are proclaiming that there is no satisfaction found apart from God and relationship with him. But life is hard. We live in a fallen world, and we are people who like our creature comforts, and we like security, and we like things that make us happy and make us feel good. We may acknowledge that God is God, but we may not live like it all the time. Second commandment, no idols. No idols. In our very fallen human desire for comforts and security, in this life, there are things that call to our hearts all the time. Calling to our hearts, try this, try that. This is what you're looking for. Come here. Go there. The commandment is all about not having an undivided heart. Recognizing that there is no life to be found apart from God. There is no comfort, no security, no happiness that is to be found in the little idols that we sometimes surround ourselves with, even the tiniest little idols. Do not give any part of your heart to anything or anyone, believing it is what you need to be happy or secure or satisfied. That's what is driving the second commandment. When we do that, we become idol worshipers, whether we know it or not. And then God becomes what? He becomes just one of a number of choices in our life. We create this little personal pantheon. God is a part of it, but there are other smaller gods. We would say that. We're theologically astute, and so we would say, well, they're just small. There's just a little habit here, a little habit there, and it brings me joy, and it brings me satisfaction, and it's a part of this pantheon. And guess what? We're back to the first commandment again. God doesn't choose to exist in a pantheon. Not even the personal pantheons of our life. And when we put God into a pantheon of other small gods in our lives, what we do is we desecrate his character and we drag his name through the mud. Remember, we've learned that his character is represented in his name. His name is an expression of who he is in all of his perfection and beauty. That conversation with Moses on the mountainside. Well, who should I tell them has sent me? I am has sent you. God's response to Moses was, I am who I am. That's me. We are God's people, the people of God belonging to the great I am. And that's what the third commandment is all about. It's more than just cussing and using the name of God. It is far more. Yeah, that's a bad idea. But it's also a really bad idea to not live your life in a way that gives evidence that you have taken on the name of God. Do not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. It's the idea that I identify myself with God and then I don't think it's any big deal. Come on. We're the people of God. You know, we are the children of God through Christ Jesus. That's a pretty big deal. And to not live our lives as if the new name that we have been given, child of God, to live our lives in such a way that it doesn't really matter that much, that others see a life that isn't just really sold out and completely devoted to this God who has given us his name, that is a misuse of the name of God. that is what that commandment is about. So, what's happening in this first three commandments? The people of God are being called to a God-focused, what I like to think of as a God-obsessed, God-saturated life that His people will live every single day of their lives in the midst of their daily routines. And the demand of daily living, they will live every day with this focus upon the God who has rescued them from slavery and has made them His very own possession. That they'll be obsessed with the beauty and the majesty and the wonder of who God is, and want their lives to just be completely saturated with awareness of Him and His character flowing through them in their lives. And that is, I think, most dramatically emphasized in that fourth commandment that we've talked about, the Sabbath rest. Live a life that is God-focused, God-obsessed, God-saturated every single day of the week. And then, on one day of the week, cease all the normal activity and really give yourself to a full-hearted worship and devotion and rest in who God is. You understand the flow so far? So, this life-giving theme is flowing through these commandments. Life is created by God and for God. Be about that in your life. Nothing is more important. Make it your daily goal and your daily passion. Regardless of what you put your hand to, regardless of what your vocation is, regardless of your surroundings, make your life God-focused and God-obsessed. Does this make sense so far? Okay, now think with me back to the creation mandate, to the first commandment that was given to the man and the woman in the garden setting. Remember what it was? No. Given them together. Exactly. Be fruitful and multiply. What does that mean? That means have kids. Have children. Be fruitful and multiply. What's that about? What's going on there? Was it be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth so that the earth could have more gardeners and workers? So we fill the earth so that God can have more companions? What were we created to do? Worship Him. Live in relationship with Him. And so what do with those children that we create? We teach them to do the same thing. Fill the earth with worshipers. It was what is going on in that first mandate. Fill the earth, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Have lots and lots of kids, all of you who are my people, and fill this earth with people who are obsessed with me, who are focused upon me. Are we good so far? It's God's original design that every parent on earth love and worship Him and raise their children to do the same. Filling the earth with people who live out the purpose for which they were created, to be passionate lovers of God, exalting Him with every fiber of their being, living with and for Him, and finding deep and lasting satisfaction in that, because that is the only place to find it. And the commandments were given to a people who were very fallen, living in a very fallen world, with the idea that if you give attention to these, you'll be moving back towards the relationship and the intimacy of that relationship for which you were created. That's why the Westminster Catechism states that the chief end, the purpose of humanity, is to glorify God and enjoy Him forever. You're looking pretty excited about that. I know, you're thinking about the clouds and the harp. That's such a terrible image. First things first, glorify God, and enjoy Him forever. It's what we were created for. Even in our fallen and broken world, that is still God's intention. It's just a heck of a lot harder in this fallen and broken world in which we live. Tony Campolo tells a wonderful story. Time in their children were little. His wife at that time was a stay-at-home mom. And they were at this social event. He describes it as a pretty high-powered event. There were a lot of, you know, very upwardly mobile community shakers and movers kinds of people there. And they were doing what those folks would sometimes do in those kinds of gatherings. They were trying to impress people with their titles and their positions as they introduced themselves. One of the women who Tony says he knew to be a wealthy mover and shaker asked his wife, Peggy, this question, "And what is it that you do, dear?" Her response was, "I am socializing two homo sapiens into the dominant values of the Judeo-Christian tradition in order that they might be instruments for the transformation of the social order into the kind of eschatological utopia that God willed from the beginning of creation." And she turned to the woman and said, "And what is it that you do?" Is that priceless? Parents of all ages, this is our mandate. It is the reason for having kids. It wasn't my reason for having kids, but I see it now. That is the reason to have children. We have kids for a lot of wrong reasons. I was kind of thinking more in terms of, you know, my retirement security. And to be honest, I still do. But the reason to have children is to fill the earth with worshipers of God. People who are passionate and self, people who are passionate and focused not on self, but on God. Obsessed with God, God-focused. That is the number one goal of every parent who knows God. And guess what? How are the children going to learn how to do that? They're going to watch Mom and Dad. By watching you, me, watching parents in their lives battle honestly and faithfully, diligently, to make our lives revolve around God. Not to live our lives as we choose and include God in it from time to time. One father tells this great story. When his daughters were little, he said, they were 2 or 3 years old. I noticed how they imitated and reflected my wife and me. They cooked, fed, and disciplined their play animals and dolls, just the way my wife cooked, fed, and disciplined them. They gave play medicine to their dolls, just the way that we gave them medicine. Our daughters also prayed with their stuffed animals and their dolls, the way that we prayed with them. They talked on their toy telephone with the same kind of Texas accent that my wife has when she talks on the phone. And then he makes this point. He says, all of us, even adults, reflect what we are around. We reflect things in our culture and our society. The principle is this: what we revere, what we resemble, what we revere is what we resemble, and that will either be for our ruin or our restoration. To commit ourselves to some part of the creation more than the Creator is idolatry. You know, I think it's natural for us as parents to want our kids to honor us and to obey us. We've invested much in them. For pity's sake, you owe me this, child. But why is it really that we want their honor? The Hebrew word for honor that's used in the Old Testament text comes from a verb that means to be heavy. To be weighty. So the idea is, when we give honor to someone, we're giving weight, so to speak, to the person who is honored. They're significant because of that position. It is holding someone in high esteem, elevating them to a place of importance. It's very similar to the concept of honoring God. We honor God because he's weighty. He's a heavyweight. He's a big deal. It's an important position. And so when children honor their parents, they're elevating them to a place of importance. And I would suggest that the reason that godly parents should desire for their children to honor them is because they have lived and continue to live a life that illuminates for their children who are living in this dark fallen world a life that is God-focused and God-obsessed. This commandment is about children choosing to walk in the path of life that their parents have lived and modeled before them. We always need to be asking the question, what are our children learning about God from the way that we live our lives? God is telling children in this commandment to honor their parents to choose that life for themselves because it is the path of life. To choose a life without him at the center is a path to destruction. And I think that's what's going on in that harsh Deuteronomy text that we read. The kid is not being stoned because he refused to take out the trash or water the donkeys. He has become someone that God's people are not. He had become an idolater. He worshipped his own life and his drink and his entertainments and not God. He had chosen a path apart from the path that his parents, assuming, had lived before him. I think we err in our understanding of that text if we think that his parents were eager to do this. Oh, let's take him to the elders. Can't wait to get rid of him. What parent feels that way? Well, not often anyway. You know, there's just no evidence in Scripture that that happened. No parent wanted that. The emphasis is upon the parents to live a life that makes God attractive to their children. Do we make God attractive to our children? Frankly, I don't think that has ever changed as God's priority for his people. That they live their lives in such a way that they make him attractive. Because we're fallen creatures, it's easy to make our kids' lives and their choices about us rather than about God. As a pastor, the numbers of times over the years that I have longed for my children to make their choices based upon my image. Because if they do this, what's my congregation going to think? If they act like this, what are these folks going to think of me? Hello, guy! It's not about you! It's about God. When we make those kinds of demands upon our children, when ourself and our self-image, subtle as it may be, becomes the driving force upon our desire for them to honor us and to even obey us, we're taking our idols and we're foisting them upon our children. And we're making them idol worshipers. Why do I want my children to obey me? Is it about me? Because I am the exalted authority in their lives and they need to obey me? Or is it because I've been given the responsibility in my life to live a God-focused, God-obsessed life because I am convinced that that is the only way to find fulfillment in this life and for all of eternity, to satisfy the longing of my soul for the God-created design that is there? And I believe that so strongly that that's what I want for my children. And I'm living it and I'm modeling it. And I'm living it and I'm modeling it again and again and again. And so out of that flows my desire for them to learn obedience, because obedience is all about a life that is focused and obsessed upon and with God. I fear when I think about some of the things that I've said and done over the years in the lives of my kids, I fear that I've taught them more about worshiping idols than living a life that is focused upon God and obsessed with him. And I know this seems really simplistic, I know there's a whole lot more to parenting. This is not a parenting class. This is a foundational truth that underlies this commandment that I think sometimes we may pull out of context and cause it to mean something other than what is really going on here. I think it's a driving force behind this commandment is that godly parents are living a life that is attractive to their children, that they will honor their parents by choosing to make God the obsession of their own lives. There's so much more that we could say to flesh that out, but you get the idea. That is the foundational principle that's at work here. Let me just, in a couple of minutes, sort of change gears, kind of turn the coin and flip it over for just a moment. I know that there are many of you, my brothers and sisters, in here, you have grown up or you grew up with parents, some of you still have them, that were not honorable in terms of the life that they modeled for you. And I know that for many of you, your memories of pain and neglect and abuse are still very, very raw. I believe that you still have an opportunity, and I would say an obligation, even though it is difficult to obey the command to love, to honor your parents. Very much the same kind of a command that the New Testament projects upon believers for the office of the king or the office of certain public leaders. There is a respect for the office, even though you might not think a whole lot of the person. As followers of Jesus, it's imperative, I think, that we see everyone that crosses our path as persons in need of the grace of God through Christ Jesus. I think sometimes in our pain, and it's such a human thing to do, we objectify those who have caused us pain, who have disappointed us, who have hurt us. And I think that there is something so enormously powerful about the destruction that a broken family unit does to a person's life, because it was designed to be the unit that would launch people into a life of health and vitality and God focus and God obsession. And so it seems like the same power that is potentially there for living a healthy life that just zooms ahead for the glory of God, that same power is potentially destructive in the life of a person because the unit that God designed it to be broke. It broke. It's important to remember, my brothers and sisters, and I hope I say this sensitively to you, that when we have been brought into a relationship with God through His Son, Christ Jesus, we have been made new, we have been brought into a new family, and we have been given the opportunity to experience emotions and satisfaction and safety and belonging that many of us never experienced growing up. God brings us the possibility of letting go of the expectations that sometimes we continue to hold on to that haunt us and cause us great pain, to let go and to see those parents who failed us as people in need, desperate need, of the same grace that God has dawned in your life. Christ has become for you what they never were. And I would suggest to you that the greatest honor that you could show to them, because they occupy that parent position, that position of honor, even though they're not honorable, the greatest honor that you could show them is to show them a God-focused, God-obsessed life. Show them the kind of life that they were supposed to show you but didn't. Maybe they chose not to. Maybe they couldn't. Who knows? Honor them by showing them the kind of life that they were supposed to model and show for you. Praise team, why don't you come on up? We need to close this morning. I just want to read a couple of lines from a story. One of the most powerful stories I think I have ever read about a woman who was in a Bible study and they were studying the Ten Commandments in Exodus. She said, "I felt pretty smug. After all, I didn't worship more than one God, steal, commit adultery or murder, lie about my neighbors, or plot to cheat them out of what was rightfully theirs. But one evening we came the command to honor our father and mother. And against my own will, I thought of my mother who'd passed away 10 years earlier. Honor her? When I felt more relief than sorrow at her death? The tears I cried at her funeral were those of an adult daughter who had never heard the words I most needed from her. I'm proud of you." She goes on to talk about a lot of the mess, a lot of the hurt, a lot of the pain that she carried with her for years and years and years. Even after her wedding, her mother's attitude towards her and her new husband continued to spiral downward and be anything but pleasant. She said, "That night at the Bible study, God did something in me and I came face to face with my hardened heart. To harbor contempt and anger, to shut someone out of your life and memory because of perceived hurt or injustice, these aren't the attitudes of forgiveness. I knew firsthand that they punish the victim more than they do the villain. I left the Bible class that night convicted to the core, but how was I to honor, to love and respect and esteem a parent I held responsible for so much heartache? And I began admitting that I needed God's help, not only to confront my feelings toward her, but also to confess my selfishness and lack of compassion. I acknowledged with gratitude that she gave me life and nurtured me the best she was able. I took into account the factors that had shaped her life, not the least of which were her own dysfunctional parents and later the lure of religious teachings that distorted God's truth." She goes on about just committing these sorts of things to the Lord in prayer. She says, "I took down a picture of my mom and I stared at it a long time and I said, 'I'm sorry.' I silently told my mother, 'I haven't honored you. I've tried to push you from my conscious thought. I forgive you and I pray you've also forgiven me for turning away from you. I want your memory to be a part of my life.' An incredible peace filled me as God enabled me to do what I couldn't do on my own. Remember my mother with love. Suddenly I saw her as God created her to be and was able to forgive and in a small way forget the hurtful things that had passed between us. Then an even more amazing thing happened. The bitter, condemning frown I'd always pictured and seen in my mom's portrait now appeared as a serene smile. In my mother's eyes, I saw the acceptance and the approval for which I had yearned. My greatest regret is that I was unable to reach this place of forgiveness while my mother was still alive. For other adult children," she says, "of difficult parents, there may still be time. Even if you see a little hope that he or she will ever become the loving, responsive parent for which you long. With God, heart change is always possible."